Everyone, and welcome to those who have just arrived. Yesterday, Michael read a verse attributed to Bodhidharma, who I think everyone knows is the Indian monk who is said to have brought Zen or Chan to China, and that was around 487, Common Era. And he was later declared to be the first patriarch of Chan or Zen. And the verse goes, my version, I can't help tinkering with translations, so it's a little different from what Michael read. A special transmission outside the sutras, not based on words and letters, pointing directly to the human heart. And of course, heart and mind are the same, or one character in Chinese, pointing directly to the human heart and mind, seeing true nature, attaining Buddhahood. And as Michael also mentioned, this verse, or what's expressed in this verse, has been used over the centuries by some to justify the complete rejection of texts in Zen practice. Others have been more generous towards the role texts can play. But that's not the point right now. My point in bringing this verse forward again is to let you know that probably Bodhidharma never said that or wrote it. This verse only appears in writing for the first time more than 500 years after he lived. And it was probably used to strengthen Chan's position as establishing Chan's position as a lineage extending all the way from the Buddha through Bodhidharma to that present time. A lineage transmitted in a special way, mind to mind, from teacher to disciple. Now, Zen masters through the centuries have also repeatedly subverted this message, saying, there is no thing to be transmitted. Right. Just a mutual recognition, a mutual participation in awakening. Because none of us, no one, can awaken outside that web of complete interconnection with others. Dogen Zenji, our Japanese Zen ancestor, put it this way: Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can completely master it. I really like that. So before I go any further, though, I have a confession to make. I'd been practicing Zen in Japan for several years before I realized that these little images, these little scowling figures that you see all over Japan are actually an image of Bodhidharma. They're called Daruma. Sometimes they're called Daruma dolls. He's become a kind of folk religious icon in Japan. When you buy one of these, you can get them at Shinto shrines or Buddhist temples, who knows where. You paint in one eye and make a wish. And then when your wish is fulfilled, you paint in the other eye. And then there are certain notice, this guy's probably, I've probably had him for 35 years. I guess I haven't saved all beings yet. But then when your wish is fulfilled, you see these in Japanese stores. You've seen the beckoning cat? The good luck cat? Sometimes he's right beside the cat, right? And then there are times when you take the two-eyed Dharma with the wish fulfilled and make an offering and they're burned. So it's both, maybe a folk practice that kind of seems light in some way, but there's also something profound about this being part of everyday life in Japan and moving. So I started Zen practice with very simple basic Zazen instructions based on Dogen Zenji's instructions. So I didn't know the first thing about Bodhidharma or Zen ancestors. We were just taught to sit upright, think not thinking, and manifest our lives from moment to moment, just as they are. That was the basic practice. And I found that revelatory, profound, and very nonverbal. It was about a radical acceptance of my light, which I had not been terribly accepting of. And it was all-inclusive. So I didn't really care much about the old Zen masters whose names I couldn't keep straight once I started hearing them mentioned or reading about them. They seemed like they were always hitting and hitting each other and yelling at each other, trying to, you know, show off and outdo each other with incomprehensible statements. I was also pretty skeptical about Westerners trying to imitate them and grafting that way of practice onto our already competitive and achievement-oriented habit patterns. Seemed too much like school kids saying, "What did you get? Did you pass?" You know? And I didn't want to go there with my Zen practice. So it took me a while to get acquainted with old Baijiang and Zhao Zhou and Dongshan and the many other characters that appear in the Zen koan literature. But I have become quite fond of them. Their words and the images they evoke have become touchstones in my practice, reminders to wake up, let go of my self-focus, and receive the teachings of the 10,000 things all around me, right in front of me. I'm grateful to Jan Chosen Bays of Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, who offered me a way of practicing with koans that was not the conventional curriculum style, and to my teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, who brought his poetic sensibility and his down-to-earth wisdom to his Dharma talks about the koans. At some point, he decided he was going to give a talk on every koan in the Blue Cliff Record. I forget if he did the Book of Serenity too. Anyway, he did a lot, and it opened doors for me. Also, I'm very grateful to our friends Sue Moon and Florence Kaplow, who did a labor of love in researching for their book called The Hidden Lamp, which is 100 stories of women in the Buddhist tradition, not only Zen, and with commentaries by contemporary women teachers. So it helped tremendously to know that there were women from the beginning practicing with great courage and wisdom and also plucky irreverence, just like the old stories of the men. When I first talked to my teacher about Jukai, formally receiving the precepts, I said I felt fine about making that commitment to the precepts, to practicing a life of benefit, of non-harming. But I wasn't so sure about joining the lineage of black-robed men. Was that just one more fraternity of exclusion that I would self-eject from or be ejected from. I tend to self-eject before the anticipated ejection. Since then, scholars and teachers have researched the history of women, as I've said, and there is now has been created a women's heritage document, so that when we receive Jukai or offer Jukai, we give that document along with the traditional lineage paper. And those of you who have one, you know how it's quite beautiful, beautifully designed in a circle instead of a line. Also, since that time that I was ignorant, I have also learned that the lineage of the Chinese Zen ancestors that we receive in that list is not historically or chronologically accurate. It's a construct, and it was created to give Chan a legitimacy in Chinese society and in the Buddhist world then, according to the Chinese values of family lineage. One of the scholars who's really studied this a lot is John McCrae, says that whenever we pretend to explain Chan in terms of lineal succession from one great master to another, we run the risk of what he calls the string of pearls fallacy. These shining masters connected by one string. And I thought, to use a different metaphor, we could suggest a family tree that's been neatly pruned instead of representing the true tangle that it is. You know, an intricate tangle of relationships is more accurately what happened. In McCrae's book, he gives examples of Chan students who studied with a series of different masters, often from different schools, teachers who had a number of Dharma heirs, only one of whom made the list, right? The women didn't make the list. Whole branch lineages which faded away. So much was left out. Much is left out of that linear lineage. And much of this history has only come to light really in the 20th century, since there was an amazing discovery of what are called the Denghuang Caves in 1900. But it took a while for the contents of these amazing documents they were kind of scattered. Different scholars from different countries kind of took their share. There was, I think, competitive appropriation of these documents, and only gradually were they translated and revealed more accurately the history of Chan in China. And then, of course, in the communist revolution, the Buddhism was suppressed, as it had been a number of times previously. So what came to the West was not initially, in the early to mid 20th century, was not Chinese Buddhism, it was Japanese Buddhism, and particularly post-World War II. A Japanese version where Rinzai Zen and Soto Zen were quite separate, and particularly version of Rinzai Zen that was first presented a lot by D.T. Suzuki became almost caricatured as these fierce, long-eyebrowed Zen masters hitting their humble students with sticks when they fall asleep or can't answer their koan correctly. So McCrae gives an alternative to the string of pearls fallacy by sort of a phase model of Chan history. And I don't want to make this an academic history lesson. and I'm far, far from an expert in the field. The reason I want to bring this into view is so that we can see our own practice from a very spacious perspective, a sort of a deep time perspective, because we are part of this very old, ongoing stream. We're a branch. We're branching. We're branching streams. In fact, that is the name of the organization that connects Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki Shunryu Roshi sanghas around North America that Michael and I just attended week before last, Branching Streams, is what they call it. So, here goes. McRae calls the first few generations post Bodhidharma proto-chan. There's very little historical evidence of Bodhidharma's existence, but there are wonderful legendary stories that Michael will talk about next week. These weren't written down until several hundred years after his lifetime. Whoever he was, Bodhidharma did not found the Chan school of Zen any more than Jesus founded Christianity or Buddha founded Buddhism. In the early years of those years of spiritual practice, small groups gathered around a teacher, a spiritual leader, and simply practiced together. Right? It was very decentralized. There's no institution. And often they were in some way expressing some radical simplicity of practice in contrast to what was established in their time institutionally. Often they moved from place to place. This was the case in these proto-Chan generations. And as Michael said yesterday, what became Chan was really a mixture. It was an emphasis on meditation, because that's what, I don't think he mentioned yesterday that the word Chan comes from jhana in Sanskrit, which is meditation. Along with influences from Chinese Taoist and Confucian traditions, along with influences from other Mahayana schools that were already established in China, which came along the Silk Road as early as the first century CE. So this early stage produced very little in the way of texts and documentation, and no concept of lineage. And then from about 600 to 900 was a period called the Tang Dynasty, which was relatively stable, very strongly stable for some time. McRae calls this early Chan, and this is when stable monasteries emerged, widely spread throughout the empire, with different groups and factions arising in around particular masters. So a time of evolutionary diversity, right? If you think in terms of evolution. Some specialized in the study of texts. Some specialized in detailed adherence to the monastic rules. And Chan specialized in meditation. More and more monasteries became urban and were supported by regional and imperial patronage. So this is when the lineage records began to be kept, retrospectively, filling in the gaps, kind of arranging the lineage to look, to give it a continuity. and coherence. So towards the end of that period, esoteric Buddhism, so that's the tantric tradition, arrived from India. That came after Zen. And started, sorry. And began to compete with Chan for patronage. It was the latest fad among the elite, with its colorful ceremonies and drama and promise of special powers. That's how esoteric Buddhism first appeared. At the same time, the Tang Dynasty started a gradual period of collapse with great civil and political instability. As empires tend to do, it had become overextended and corrupt, burdening the peasants with increased taxes and military conscription, leading, of course, to discontent and rebellion. And the government was threatened by the power and assets that Buddhist monasteries had accrued. And they were seen as a threat to Confucian values. They were an economic drain because they didn't pay taxes. And they weren't monks weren't economically productive. And they didn't produce children. They didn't, to replenish the population. So there was a period then of suppression of government seizing monastic assets, destroying monasteries, forcing thousands of monks and nuns to disrobe and return to lay life. In addition to political chaos, there was a series of natural disasters, horrible floods, followed by crop failures, famine, disease. Hundreds of thousands of people died. As Michael mentioned yesterday, Chan monasteries tended to be in the mountains, because that's a good place to meditate, right? So they fared better than the big urban monasteries. They had a kind of capacity for innovation and resourcefulness that gave them the resilience to survive. Also, the adoption of work practice, where the monks themselves raised their food and did their work instead of indentured peasants. So we have inherited that value of work practice, right? In the way we practice today. Another thing that happened around the same time is that the source of new Buddhist texts dried up. Buddhism was in decline in India and the areas like present-day Afghanistan where Buddhist culture had been thriving because Islamic invaders had destroyed and suppressed Buddhism. So no new teachings and texts were arriving. At the same time that the Chinese imperial support for translation, which used to be supported by government, dried up. So this is when Chan masters and disciples what originally I think were just the spontaneous interactions of daily life in a monastery, these came to be seen as teachings and used as teachings more and more, those kind of dynamic encounters and dialogues that we know now as koans, right? Came from daily life, came from the travels on pilgrimage. So in one of those encounters, a monk arrived to study with the master Xuanzha, saying, "I have entered this monastery, please show me where to enter the way." And Xuanzha answered, "Do you hear the sound of the valley stream?" "Yes." "Then enter there," Xuanzha said. Such a simple answer. "What do you hear?" "The valley stream." "Enter there." that still resonates after our practice with sound and listening earlier this year, doesn't it? Xuanzha is telling the monk to start right now, in this moment, with this sound of rushing water. Enter right there, and you are entering the stream of awakened ancestors. Remember that when you step the first step on the path, you're called a stream enterer, right? From way back in the time of the Buddha. Many of these old stories have to do with mundane tasks, such as preparing or eating food. Another monk said to Master Zhaozhou, "I have just entered the monastery, please teach me." And Zhaozhou said, you know this one, many, "Have you eaten your rice gruel?" "Yes, I have." "Then wash your bowl." So simple. Just do the next thing and do it thoroughly, right? Don't jump ahead of yourself. So the more I got acquainted with these old characters and their different styles of teaching, I was delighted to discover that it wasn't all about whacking and yelling. I could even appreciate some of the whacks and yells. But one of my favorites is this one. It's an exchange between two Dharma brothers who were going on pilgrimage together, which they often did. They came to a ford, in a place where they had to cross a rushing stream. This one's for anybody who made a mistake during this retreat, or worried about making a mistake during this retreat, right? Zen really kind of brings that up for us. So Dongshan said, "Don't make a misstep or you'll slip into the current." And Shanshan said, "If I make a misstep or a mistake, I won't live to cross the river." And Dongshan asked, "What is the state of no mistakes? What is the state of no mistakes?" And his companion answered, "Me now, crossing the river with you, elder brother." No mistakes, just carefully crossing the river together. So we'll come back to these characters in the coming weeks, these and some others. But just a little more about the next phase of Zen, Chan, was out of that period of chaos and collapse, and this took some generations and some temporary short-lived empires, came the Song Dynasty, a next period of stability, and Chan emerged as the dominant Buddhist stream. And these encounter dialogues started to be recorded, and they were recorded in colloquial language rather than, you know, high-flown literary language. And they included stories, dialogues that had been handed down orally and then altered and embroidered, right, in the telling, just as all folk traditions are. So they're not historically accurate. Sometimes they even depict characters who historically might not even, probably didn't even know each other. But they became the basis for new Zen texts, right? So that in the later part of the Song Dynasty, these stories became called kongan or koan in Japanese, which means public case, you know, to be presented publicly. And used as teaching methods, used as objects of contemplation to help the student or the practitioner let go of rational thinking, discursive thought, and break through to an experience of Buddha nature, shall we say. After the initial collections, often a collector would collect maybe 100 of these stories and then add a verse in response to each story. And then maybe a couple of generations after that, someone else would take that collection and write, add commentary on both the story and the verse. And these commentaries would be full of further stories and references to history, historical events, and culture heroes, and folk tales. So they're very, very rich. There are many of these collections. The ones that we know best in translation are the Blue Cliff Record, the Book of Serenity, and the Gateless Gate, or Gateless Barrier, Mumonkan. These old stories and dialogues use words to subvert words and go beyond words. And that's why we rational materialist Westerners find them so frustrating and impenetrable. But the image of Chan monasteries full of monks concentrating on koans is a bit of another myth that we've perpetuated here in the West, as is the really sharp divide between Rinzai and Soto practice. That's something we've acquired really from Japan. And the split between sudden enlightenment, what's called sudden enlightenment, and gradual enlightenment, which I'll talk about in a few weeks, as a false dichotomy. Enlightenment couldn't be anything other than sudden, and it couldn't be anything other than gradual. More about that later. But often within the same monastery, there would be groups of monks practicing koans, others practicing Pure Land chanting the Buddha's name, others who did primarily work practice. And there was probably movement between those groups. And there was movement from monastery to monastery. It was pretty much expected that when a monk would receive Dharma transmission from his or her teacher, that they would go on a pilgrimage from monastery to monastery and test their understanding. So you might begin to wonder if so much of Chan is just legend or historical reconstruction or culturally conditioned, why embrace it? Why not just go back and practice Theravada Buddhism as the closest to what the Buddha taught? Well, even that, Theravada Buddhism and how it was transmitted in India was already mixed with legend, historical reconstruction, and cultural conditioning. Religions are artifacts of human culture, subject to change. And we are no more ancient Indians than we are medieval Chinese. We are living in a big multicultural city in Canada. Chinese culture contributed its particular gifts to the Buddhist tradition, as has Japanese culture, and as Western culture now is also doing. Buddhist institutions have not been exempt from being co-opted by the power agendas of ruling kings, emperors, governments, military powers. We just have to look at Myanmar today. But to my knowledge, Buddhist thought and practice has always spread by peaceful means, not by, through exchange and trade, not by being forcefully imposed. And it has both influenced and been influenced by each culture it enters. These old Chan stories and dialogues are important not because of their historical accuracy, but because of their imaginative power to open our hearts and minds. And the traditional statements of lineage are meaningful not because they're historically accurate. They're not. But because they can represent for us a stream of continuous practice handed down, warm hand to warm hand, as one expression goes, through practice in community. We can exercise caution in our tendency to romanticize, whether we're romanticizing the golden age of Chan or some charismatic present-day Zen master, knowing that romanticizing makes us more likely to cynically dismiss what we deem as lesser. So with those caveats in mind, we'll venture forth in the coming weeks and become better acquainted with some of the important figures and maybe some lesser ones from the different phases of Chan history. And we really want to encourage you to see how their lives and teachings relate to your life, your everyday life and practice, so many centuries later. They certainly lived through times of turmoil and suffering as we do still. So what phrase or image or story will become a touchstone for you in your practice, or a koan to raise up as with a sense of inquiry? I think the particular gifts of Chan to Zen, to our Zen practice now, are the practice of a relationship of mutual awakening through practicing together. Sometimes it's in silence, sometimes it's in dialogue. Yeah. And how that then extends to every aspect of our daily lives, nothing left out. We don't have to pretend to be Tang Dynasty Zen masters and students yelling and swatting each other. But we can practice authenticity, honesty, generosity, humility, and care, and respect in our Sangha life. And in our the great Mahasangha of beings in the world. We can be open to surprise, and we can take delight in each other's expressions of the Dharma. We can practice with a little playfulness and irreverence, like those old Chan masters and monks did, to dispel the stink of Zen. You heard that phrase? You know what the stink of Zen is? Since I'm such a good Zen, Zazen person, look at, I don't budge. That's the stink of Zen. We can take up the contributions that Chan has made to the Buddhist canon of texts, taking them and appreciate them, taking them as fingers pointing to the moon, not mistaking them for the bright, clear mind of awareness, but using them as guides, prods, these old koans continue to reveal more and more as we mature in our practice. They're not once and for all, you know, crack the nut once and for all. They deepen. And we can be pragmatic like the Buddha was and recognize that the teachings are skillful means to help us awaken, to guide us on the Bodhisattva path. And that our ancestors are not just the ones on the list, but many anonymous, like the old women selling tea by the roadside who would show up the pompous Zen master coming along the road. Maybe we'll hear about them too. We can claim them and deepen our acquaintance with them and receive the gifts of their wisdom and compassion and subversiveness. We can claim them as part of our heritage of deep human inquiry into the nature of existence as we take our places in this living, evolving tradition. Already, stories of Suzuki Roshi have become iconic, passed on, retold, sometimes adapted. Wait a minute, that's not how That's not how it went. Maybe someday there will be a story that begins, one day, Myoshin and Shimon were hiking in the mountains, and they came to a raging torrent. Myoshin said, oh my God, we were here 30 years ago in this exact spot, and the glacier was here, and now the glacier is way up there. And Shimon might say, what was the face of this mountain before it was born? So I just made up the punchline. But that's how these happened, right? The first part really happened. So just in case that you find all these famous Chan masters a little intimidating because they were all monks, right? We also want to include some lay ancestors. And I want to give the last words today to a famous 8th century Chan lay layman called Layman Pong, known as Layman Pong, who was a wealthy merchant who studied with some of the great Zen masters of his day, who threw all his possessions in a river. I think today we wouldn't do that. We'd, find ways to recycle them and give them away. And he and his wife and daughter and son then, who are all, well, there aren't any stories about the son. We just know there was one. But the wife and the daughter, for sure, were practitioners, and they all made their living weaving baskets and selling baskets. Simple work. So one day, Shirto, one of the great masters that Layman Pong practiced with, said, since seeing me, since the last time we met, what have your daily activities been? Layman Pong said, when you ask me about my daily activities, I can't open my mouth. And so Shirto said, because I know you are like this, I now ask you. So Layman Pong answered with a verse, my daily activities are not unusual. I'm just naturally in harmony with them. Grasping nothing, discarding nothing. In every place, there's no hindrance, no conflict. My supernatural power and marvelous activity, drawing water and carrying firewood. Which has become a famous phrase, right? Drawing water, carrying firewood. Another day, Layman Pong was sitting in his thatched cottage reading some sutras. He said, difficult, difficult. Like trying to scatter 10 measures of sesame seed all over a tree. I don't know why you would do that, but. Then his wife said, easy, easy, like touching your feet to the ground when you get out of bed. And then his daughter said, neither difficult nor easy. On the 100 grass tips, the great master's meaning. So grass in Zen poetry and language, grass is the myriad beings, all of us. So on all the grass tips, the great master's teachings. I wonder if the days of the great masters are past. One of the 20th century great masters, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, has said that the next Buddha may be the Sangha. Ordinary people like ourselves. Bodhisattvas on the 10,000 grass tips, quietly doing the work of awakening, vowing to heal the world. I think that's what the world needs now, more than great masters. Is all of us. So Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for your practice.